Hi everyone, I'm Mark Esper. Welcome to this special additional No Spoiler Reviews podcast, where today I'll be interviewing Carl Golden about his new film, Bruno. Hi everyone, my name is Mark Esper, and today I'm talking to Carl Golden about his new film, Bruno. What can you tell me about the film?
So Bruno is the story of a man who is a homeless man who's, and I use the word loosely because it has all sorts of connotations, but he's a man basically drifting through the streets of London who only has one companion, which is a dog called Bruno. And one evening, as he's going on his nightly stroll with the dog, he's attacked by some guys and he loses the dog. And it's a story of his search for the dog and what happens along the way. He meets a young boy who's also apart from his home, and it's the two of them going on a search together for Bruno over 2 days in London.
Okay, and what drew you to the story?
It's a combination of things. Firstly, it's a moment that happened to me in my life where I was in Hackney, where I used to live, and I saw a guy coming down the street. Kind of looked like a figure from a Shakespeare play, kind of had blood, you know, coming down his face and his beard, and he looked like very rough, tattered clothes. Something had happened, and I could see as he was coming down the street that there was a stream of people sort of stepping away, and this guy was walking through with this very intense look in his eyes. And I did what everybody else did, which is I stepped away, and as he went past, I kind of turned to look at him, just walk away into the kind of down the London street, and I suddenly felt overwhelming guilt because I'm Irish, so that's obviously my first response. And secondly, I became interested in what had happened to him, that what had happened in his life. And so I began to sort of think about it, and then about a year later, I suddenly had a moment where I realized, oh yeah, of course, this might have happened. And I wrote the screenplay for Bruno. So it was kind of triggered by a real moment, and then it was fictionalized, you know?
Got it. Okay. And tell me about the casting process, because, I mean, the old adage goes, never work with kids and animals, and right. Yet you've gone for both.
Why not? I mean, yes, it is mad to do it. And at the same time, if you're making a film in the way that we made this, because the other element of the film was that I had sort of made four films in a more traditional structure with, you know, with actual budgets. And you know, distributors and much more of a mainstream structure. And then I wanted to go off and do something which I'd written again. I'd written my first film, and then I became a sort of a director for hire. And so part of that was that I wanted to do something that was a little bit more unpredictable, and I didn't intend necessarily to work with kids, although I've worked with them often, and dogs, I don't know why I do work with dogs. I'm not even a dog owner. I don't even particularly like dogs, but they pop up, and they have the same ability as kids to be, you know, they bring a different energy. I mean, good luck if you try to choreograph scenes, because something else will happen, and sometimes that's a good thing. So with this, we, you know, I put a line in the sand and said, we're shooting at this particular point, and so we greenlit ourselves, and we were going to start shooting regardless, and it was very hard to find a kid. I looked at about 200 kids, and this young kid, Woody Norman, came in, and Woody was maybe 8 at the time. He hadn't really done much, and I just really liked him. He was like a kid with, you know, he sort of had an old soul in him somehow, mm-hmm. which I discovered during the course of shooting. And so very quickly we nabbed him. And then Diarmaid Murtagh, again, if you were doing this in a traditional way, you know, you would have gone to the British stars, and you would have worked your way up or down depending on how well things were going, and you would have, you know, making a slightly left field indie film usually requires a, you know, a big name. But I'd seen Diarmaid on stage, which I came from theater originally, so that's always a sign of whether someone can act. Uh-huh. And when he came into the room for the audition, he was just this enormous guy. He was totally different to, I had imagined a sort of slightly vulnerable, you know, guy, and this huge giant came in carrying a very small bag. And he was just massive, and he was like, as if he was built of stone, and he was so different, and nobody had cast him really in dramas. He'd mm-hmm. often, really, he's usually the tough guy, you know, and he fights, or he's a Viking or a gangster, and I suddenly thought that it was really interesting to have somebody physically, we assume people like that are invincible. And so the idea of having somebody of that scale with a broken heart was really interesting. And so we took him on board as well, and it worked out really well.
One of the questions I wanted to ask was, why London? Because it has a very feral atmosphere in your film.
Mm-hmm.
What was your thinking behind that?
Well, I lived in London a long time, like 13 years, and I started to make films there. But often, when I was shooting for London, I've been everywhere. Like, we'd been Nottingham, and it was meant to be London, or, you know, Isle of Man, or something. It was always somewhere else, or Belfast, or somewhere. And I kind of, when I would walk around London, I would think, God, why does nobody really shoot London? And it's because, of course, it's outrageously expensive. And then you find that it's sort of, London is kind of, there's certain London films, there's the West London films, the Richard Curtis films, there's the East London films, which are, you know, the council estate films.
Indeed.
And it tends to be categorized like that. And yet London, in one trip down the street, is all of those things in once. You know, you have so many multiple experiences where it seems like it's dangerous, and yet somehow it's got this soul to it as well. And so I decided to do something which I had never done, which is that we wouldn't do any location scouting whatsoever. So, and because where the film was set, London feels, and that part of Hackney was where I'd lived for so long, so I knew every street. And so I built a world around all these places. And I liked that the relationship between London Fields, which is one kind of London, and then you go down around Liverpool Street Station, which is, you know, a 20-minute walk, and you're in somewhere else. So everything is, actually, we walked from every location, and we shot it mostly in sequence. And we shot it at a time of the year when London is sort of beautiful because it's turning, the leaves are turning, it's autumnal, and there's all these colors, and there's the reds of the buses, and, you know, there's just strong yellows around East London. You get all these flashes of color and smells, and yet it is a little bit threatening too, London, you know.
Yeah.
At nighttime, London feels is still a place where, you know, after midnight, you know, you've got to keep, you know, you've got to be alert. And so I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that mix. It felt right for our story. I think it'd be different in Berlin. You could do it in Berlin, but Berlin doesn't have the same underlying violence, you know, ironically, given everything that's happened here. It's a much more laid-back city. London just has this immediate tension.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you can wander around Berlin late at night and not feel any the same level of fear. Watching the film, it has a very universal story, and it did occur to me that this film could be made in a variety of different locations, and that's why I was kind of curious about why London, because London as a cinematic location quite often can be got wrong.
Right.
It's that kind of city where whenever you watch a film which deals or is centered in a place where you've lived or where you're from, you always end up playing the street spotting game of,
right,
there is no way that that character could have walked from that street and ended up in this part of,
right,
London within the space of what the story is telling us.
Yeah.
But this felt very, very rooted.
Yeah, well, I hope so. That's nice to hear. I mean, it really was, not that, of course, I'm not, you know, it's not like, you know, deceiving is part of, you know, the director's game. But with this, we really did walk everywhere, and everything literally is within range. And that was really exciting, honestly, too. So I was living right on London Fields, too. So it just, I mean, it was a dream. You kind of walk from the set, you know, it's like 50 meters to the set, and then you just spend the day walking around. You can't really make films like this in a traditional way. It is a universal story, and when the script was first circulated, there was, of course, you know, that pressure which comes,
yeah,
with people saying, well, why don't you just hold out for X, Y, and Z? Like, this is actually a commercial film. Now, of course, if I was a lot smarter, I probably would have gone down that road in terms of, you know, making a sort of left-of-field indie arty film is not, with no stars, is not really what the market is interested in.
Sure.
But it's what I wanted to do, for better or worse, and I didn't want to go down, you know, there's a sort of Disney-fied version of the film where man and boy find dog, and I... It's nice, I think, if people, some people, when we do screenings, some people orientate themselves towards that. Other people find it, you know, very sort of intense in terms of the emotional undercurrent of the film. But we deliberately went in a direction which was probably harder and grittier and more authentic than it could have been if we had got like a $10 million budget that we were doing it for. We didn't have that.
Because it definitely feels gritty and urbane. And there is that kind of blurring between kind of a slightly documentarian approach and a narrative approach. And it particularly reminded me of Stephen Frears' Dirty Pretty Things.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of people living on the edge, living on the margins of society. And I particularly enjoyed how Daniel's character is living this parallel universe where he's part of society, and yet I think with the audio design it felt like he was kind of separated.
Right.
So I was going to ask, were there any particular films or talismanic performances that you were kind of holding in your head thinking that's the vibe?
I mean, I tried not to be too influenced by anything on this particular film. Usually when I'm making a film, I've got a very specific set of films that are inspiring me, and I'm usually watching them as I fall asleep. With this one, I mean, it's funny you mentioned Stephen Frears, because I think he's one of the few filmmakers who's really interesting when he makes, well, two things. Number one, when he's a sort of outsider filmmaker, which I like, so he comes from the outside, he often goes to places, and like he's made a couple of great films in Dublin, where I'm from, for example. And I really like that, and he also really gets London, and he's able to show a sort of world within a world. And one of the things that was interesting to me when I did research is that this idea of sort of these invisible worlds that a lot of the homeless community exist in, I never wanted to. That's why at the start of this, when you said, what's it about? I sort of hesitated about the word homeless, because people immediately have an idea of what that means.
Sure.
And so we didn't have any scenes of Daniel begging, because that's not his life. His life is lived. He kind of walks the same route in the same way, and he finds these small places of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And we found, or I found when I was doing research, that this is quite a typical, this kind of solitary lifestyle, which is sort of on the margins. But if you saw somebody like Daniel on the street, like they may be in housing. They're not necessarily, you know, sleeping in a sleeping bag under a bridge like people might have a traditional view. It's more of an emotional, you know, disconnection with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these pockets you see in London all the time. You know, you see these little pockets of, and particularly around East London, you know, the dry cleaners, for example, where his friend Malik is based in a place that I knew was a fish shop in East London, and there was just always stuff happening, not illegal stuff necessarily, but the guy was always selling lots of other stuff in addition to the fish in a back room, and there was just wheeling and dealing. And these invisible spaces in London are really, I find them really interesting, like what are people really doing behind the scenes.
So I really enjoyed seeing Shota's Malik, because he seems to be the kind of the conscience, the voice that Daniel is subsuming.
He's just, again, the character was written for like a Middle Eastern actor, and I saw so many, like 100 of these unbelievable actors. And then in the middle of it all, there's this Nigerian guy. And I was just, and you know, raised in London, but to Nigerian parents. And immediately he had something about him. And it's just one of those weird things. Peter Weir, who is a director that I love, talks about directors being like detectives, that they're looking for a missing person when they're casting. And sometimes you get these things that happen. And he was a theater actor who's doing some interesting stuff now on TV. But he just has a natural warmth. That's kind of who he is. And so we were very lucky. And he just worked. You know, when you put a camera on someone like that, they just radiate a sort of warmth, which is very natural, as opposed to sort of.
Yeah, he comes with this kind of prepackaged authenticity.
Right, and he really could be. I mean, literally, when we were shooting in the Laundrette, because of course we couldn't afford to really, we could close it for like a few minutes here and there when we were shooting, but people would, you know, people came in to the Launderette and just came to him and were asking about their curtains and stuff, and he would play he would play along with it. And they were just like, oh, you know, where's Jimmy? And he's like, oh, he's off today. And he just became part of that place. He became a real fixture in there. And the same happened, by the way, with Diarmaid Murtagh, who plays Daniel. People really assumed that there was something going on with him. And in fact, at one point, when we were up in...
You notice it in the crowd shots, particularly because nobody's looking around at the camera.
Right.
And that's usually the giveaway of, oh, you're shooting in a real circumstance with real people, where they're mugging the camera, and there was none of that.
People were... They'd like to, for whatever reason, there's this weird thing that people like to disrupt a shoot if they know it's a drama. Mm-hmm. And it is true that if it's a documentary, people don't do that. So we didn't... I think once... in all the footage we shot, just once somebody just even looked in the lens, but otherwise all the eyes were on him. But at one point we were shooting up in Hackney Road, and this old guy who was completely drunk off his face came over to Diarmaid, who was obviously dressed in character playing the scene, and he was like, you know, you stole my bag. You stole my vodka, and my vodka was in my bag. And he just assumed that he was this guy that he had got drunk with, mm-hmm, the previous night. And we had to sort of gently sort of break up the scene. And that's what you want on films like this. That's what you want, is that people sort of blend into the territory.
Because I was wondering how often reality bled into the fantasy that you're creating.
Yeah, I mean, you know, shooting in London, like I said to everybody, we were a tiny crew. And I said to everybody, like, let's just see what happens. And mostly it's good stuff, you know. We had, I might as well say, no permission for any of this, which is what it is. You can't make a film like this. We were allowed one or two things. And, you know, we knew that, for example, in The Pavements, for anyone who wants to make a micro-budget film in London, basically the pavements are yours so long as you don't put a tripod down. You can sort of do as long as you're not in the way, mm-hmm, and you're less than, whatever, 10 people. So you have a lot of flexibility. Obviously, stuff like parks is tricky. Playgrounds, you know, we said we were going to be in there, and they had no idea that we would have motorbikes or we'd set the playgrounds on fire or anything like that. But things happen, and good and bad. You know, shooting at nighttime in London, you know, we had a few moments that were a little tense, shall we say, with people. And in London Fields, it used to be a big gang park. It's not so much anymore, but, you know, one of the nights... We were, you know, approached and sort of it was suggested that we might want to give some money over to some people in order to be allowed to continue shooting. So stuff like that happens. I think it's a constant stuff for the actors, that because they have to walk down the street and they have to actually literally get out of the way of people and people get out of the way of them, it puts them constantly under pressure. That they're what you want is for the actors not to think about what they're meant to be saying or doing. Mm-hmm. And for that, shooting in live streets that are uncoordinated is a fantastic thing.
How much input did you get from the cast, and did that actually affect the drive and the outcome of the plotline and the story? Because there was one of the things I really enjoyed about the film was that each time it settled down, I thought, oh, it's going to go this way.
Right.
Particularly when Daniel gets back to Izzy's house. And I was thinking, all right, I'm expecting a confrontation.
Right.
And yet you didn't go down that road.
Yeah. I mean, we like, you have to be open. I mean, if you've written the script and you're directing it, you know, unless somebody sort of challenges you and stuff, you're likely just to shoot exactly what's on the page, which is pretty much the nightmare for, you should never be just going, that shouldn't be your goal. Mm-hmm. So it was challenged along the way plenty of times. And actually, strangely, what was great was Diarmaid Murtagh playing Daniel would often come to me and say, I don't need to say that. I don't need to say that. And, he, the really sure, confident actors will cut their dialogue. Mm-hmm. The insecure ones will add to their dialogue, you know, and Diarmaid kept cutting his dialogue, which I really, really liked. And so I think for the first 17 minutes, he doesn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And then he says, Bruno, that's the first thing he basically says. And so I liked that, because I think my initial concept for this character was that he was sort of somebody who was talking more to people over the course of the story, and he felt like he's just looking for this connection. And then, you know, when I stripped the script back, and then when I cast Dermot, I realized actually there's something really interesting about this guy who's carrying this weight, and you're waiting and you're waiting, and he, you know, he does finally, he's sort of able to speak about something, but only when he's in the right place emotionally.
Indeed, it does feel that the characters are, well, the principal characters, certainly Izzy and Daniel, are walking wounded.
Right.
They're actually carrying around wounds that they can't address, they can't vocalize, and that's the common ground between them.
Yeah, definitely, and when I first moved to London, I lived in Camden, and I lived across very close to a place where a lot of Irish, particularly a lot of Irish guys would live, a lot of them with alcohol problems. And there were guys that had come over, you know, in the 70s and 80s, worked in the roads or the railroads, and they kind of got lost, and they couldn't find their way back home. And I remember being struck by, you'd see them sometimes sitting around together, but they would never, they would almost never talk. And there was a sort of silence there. And Irish in particular, the character was not originally written as Irish, but once Dermot came on, he became Irish, and it made sense as well that he would, somehow Irish people are very good at keeping their emotional turmoil trapped on the inside. And the bond of a child who also is carrying his own burden but can't really seem to talk about it, that's kind of interesting to watch, you know?
Because, yes, when you're watching the film, you're waiting for the vocalization, you're waiting for the revelation.
Right, right.
Or the twin revelation.
Right, and it, you know, and obviously, you know, it's hard to judge at what point, how long will people stay with something. My tolerance for not understanding a film is pretty high. Like, I like to, I don't, but I can enjoy an incredibly mainstream, well-crafted drama where information is fed to you the whole time. But there's a curiosity about films which, you know, hold something just a little bit close for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But you need somebody. Dermot is just, what we found in screenings along the way is that people just liked this guy, even though they weren't sure about him. And we had different versions of the film where there was darker versions of him too, which pushed people away a little bit more, but they still came back because there's something about on screen, if people sense a vulnerability, they'll forgive anything if they can see vulnerability, because it's like a crack that connects one human being to another. And so, because he had this strange vulnerability in him, people weren't put off by him, even if they felt like he was a dangerous force. We had people thinking that, is this guy a danger to this young boy? But somehow there was that vulnerability in him allowed people to make a connection with him and want to find out a little bit more about what had happened.
So is this the overarching theme, you think, in the rest of your work?
I have no idea. Maybe. I mean, now that I've returned to writing stuff, I find that, yeah, I'm certainly interested. I'm not that interested. I mean, I would not be the person to make a film about a very complete character who just needs to add, you know, romance to their life to have everything perfect. That wouldn't be, I'm not that interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
I love scenes I've noticed in almost every film that I've done, there's always a scene where a character goes into the bathroom, closes the door and sits by the sink and maybe looks in the mirror. I don't know why I find that really interesting, but I think it's the only place where people who are often themselves is like in a locked bathroom. And I find like what people, how they present themselves in the outside world and how they really are is certainly interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Outsiders, I mean, the film we're just in post-production with at the moment is, we shot in Berlin, and it's about an outsider, a woman coming from Mexico to Berlin to find something. And so certainly films about outsiders seem to be doing a lot about people having emotional turbulence that they're trying to make sense of. But hopefully I'll do a car chase film or something after this. There's only so much emotional turbulence.
And then you'll just kind of revert back to, okay, we need...
Yeah, and then I'll make the car chase movie, but about sort of emotionally turbulent people. I mean, you do end up sort of, I mean, I've tried to make different things, but you do end up, in terms of the emotional underbelly of a film, you do end up sort of drifting towards things that just are of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no sense of why this is of interest, but right from the very beginning, the first image I saw was, as I said, the guy coming down the street, and then somehow I had another image of a guy coming up an elevator, and it's the same guy, and
mm-hmm.
And something has happened over the course of the story, and you just go towards those things if you can make a film like this. And I should say, we made it, you know, in our particular way. I think if it was in a much more structured way, there would have been different demands on it creatively. Mm-hmm. But I was able to do this kind of the way I wanted.
So you feel this film was made free of expectation, or?
There's always an expectation. I mean, the world we live in now, I mean, even from when we first started to make the film to now, a lot of things have changed. And, you know, for indie films, it's been a kind of, they've been going one direction, and it's not a good direction for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, because there's just less outlets for them, cinemas are less interested in them because they're harder sells. People buy fewer tickets. If you've got, you know, Fast and Furious 27 next to a film about a homeless guy and a dog, you know, it's very hard for them to compete. And without sort of a big name star at the heart of the film that they can hang, it is much harder to make films like this. And so there's a sense of expectation in the sense that creatively, no, I wanted to go off and do this, mistakes and all, heart on my sleeve, to make a film that I wanted to make. A camera, a story, an actor, that's what I wanted to do, and mm-hmm. I'm tremendously excited by having done that. In terms of expectations in the market, of course, that's something else, because while we're doing okay with the film and sales, and we're about to go on release here in Germany and maybe Austria too, and we've been picked up in the UK and Ireland by a great distributor, and we have a few other things happening, hopefully maybe in America, small scale release, but you know, it's a very difficult time for small films. So you reduce it and you kind of go, well, okay, Netflix in a strange way, and these places can occupy places for smaller films.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's now with everything else, with Corona as well, it has become very hard for these small films. So I think if you make these films and expect to go to Sundance and then be picked up by A24 for general release in the US, you're probably going to be disappointed. But you find films and that find a way
mm-hmm.
in great festivals, get picked up with great distributors, and with us, that's what's happening too. We've had some great festival experiences. We were in Estonia for Black Nights as well, which was fabulous and has opened up all sorts of doors. And Dermot, you know, Dermot was just nominated in the States at Worldfest in Houston as best actor. So like with Stellan Skarsgård. So that was nice for him. So, you know, we're finding our audience
mm-hmm.
and we're delighted with that. And Woody, our young actor who had made one tiny film, he got picked up to star or co-star with Joaquin Phoenix in a film by Mike Mills, who's a really nice director from the US, which is now actually being distributed by A24 early next year. So there's a journey that a film goes on, and there's a journey that the actors go on as a result of the film, which is all part of, you know, if you expect too much as opposed to being open, then nothing would happen. But if you're open to things, unusual things happen, you know.
That was kind of leading on to something I was going to ask about. How do you see the future for independent cinema?
I mean, look, it's a very complicated question, from something I've been thinking about a lot actually during lockdown. And I grew up adoring film. It's all I ever wanted to do, and it's all I've ever done. Some of my heart has sort of been broken a little bit by just how complicated it is to put films out. I think if you want to keep on doing the same thing, so I was occupying a space of sort of these indie films for a long time, you know, it's harder to be in that space. And if you just want to keep on doing the same thing, as in making an indie film in the same way and expecting different results, it's a form of madness, because
mm-hmm.
you know, it is different. And so if you're making indie films now, I think you have to be a lot smarter about how you're going to literally position it afterwards in the market. I mean, one thing is that I am a little bit surprised that there is no platform that's kind of no recognized global platform for indie films. I mean, there's interesting platforms. I've been watching a lot of Mubi recently, which has been great, but I mean, Mubi's owned by Sony, you know, so mm-hmm. you're still within the system. They do actually have great films. And I'm a little surprised that there's nothing that's sort of a little bit more, you know, diverse in mm-hmm. its choices, although their choices are quite diverse, but like real indie films that nobody's kind of going around now. And I think it's in the works because these festivals are going online. Like Mubi actually have relationships now with festivals where they're showing streaming films from festivals. And I think it is moving in the direction, mm-hmm. which is a bit of a sad direction, because what you're basically saying to people is like, this idea of a bricks and mortar physical space, cinema, isn't that important, because you can sit at home mm-hmm. and you can just, you don't even have to go to a film festival. You can sure. just, and I find that a little tragic, but at the same time, it's kind of the way things are going. So the very long answer to your question is, I think indie films have to adapt. They have to be smarter about how they're adapting, the same way like Hollywood commercial films have adapted to new audiences and new markets. Indie films, this idea that you could have that sleeper hit, you know, you somehow get picked up and then, yeah, you know what, distributors will put you out. It doesn't exist like that anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be really distributed now, people are having to put in a reasonable investment. And it's like a significant risk, you know, because, and now with cinemas, over the last few months, people have got very comfortable with watching stuff in their living rooms. I'm noticing a huge exodus towards television, obviously, sure. amongst indie filmmakers that I know. I myself, included in the sense that I'm working on another two television projects at the moment. It's not that it's any better in TV. It's just that there's a product that just needs to be delivered all the time. Mm-hmm. And indie films, there will be gems that will come up. They're the ones that I always look out for as well. But it is very, very hard. On one hand, anyone can pick up a camera right now, today, and they can just make their film. And mm-hmm. they can, you know, edit it at home, and they can put it out into the world. How, the answers aren't there yet for how you connect if you're sitting at home and wherever you are in Russia or Thailand or Peru when you're making your film, how do you connect with a global thing? Because cinema and the old-fashioned distribution is nonsense. It doesn't work anymore.
I'm curious, and I was wondering whether sort of festival movies, indie movies, would get a sort of like a second bite, a chance to step into that vacuum and actually occupy the sort of the delivery space that's going to be open.
Yeah. There is an element of that for us at the moment. Yes, there is an element of for our little film. There's an element of because they need they just need product. You know, a lot of these platforms and countries just and you know television broadcasters, they need product. So we've certainly through our sales agent, we've been able to go into spaces maybe we wouldn't have before in terms mm-hmm. of you know sales and stuff. So it's not. You know, for sure there's right now, people are nervous. I can see Netflix all the time continually putting on more films from the 70s and 80s and not particularly good ones because they don't have enough new product. So, mm-hmm. but that they'll catch up with that soon. And when people, you know, I think the interesting thing was like what happens next year
yeah.
for indie films? You know, will people really come out? I mean, because we're talking here in Berlin, where in Berlin there's a very strong market for these small cinemas and people go.
Yeah.
And I go and I love these small spaces. People like to go in, they have their beer, they watch a film, and there's just, it never occurs to them that it's an art house cinema or an indie mm-hmm. cinema. It's just like, it's a great cinema. Now that they've been shut down for so long, and now they're reopening with sort of less capacity, will the market still be there in a year's time? Will people have just got over this? Will they return? It's interesting, but I do think it's a wake-up call mm-hmm. for indie films. How do you register? How do you make your film register in the world a little bit? The trick in the past was just, oh yeah, you know, you cast like a movie star in the role, but that doesn't work anymore either. Mm-hmm. So of course, great product will find a way through. But for all of these interesting indie films that get left behind, often I'm hoping a platform is one solution or a new type of festival, because I think, you know, the kind of Sundances. Sundance is an amazing festival, but it's not what it was designed to be.
Yeah.
You know, 20, 30 years ago, it was designed as something else, to be a discovery festival.
Yeah.
It's not a discovery festival anymore. It's a red carpet festival.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I know in Berlin, there's alternative festivals opening up all the time, and trying to find, maybe there's a new festival that can somehow connect with platforms and find a way to do it slightly better. It all seems a little bit old-fashioned to me right now. When I see like a bunch of sales agents kind of meeting in the south of France every year or in Berlin and sort of like sort of giving screeners to each other, it's a very strange way of doing business. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you could be optimistic and say that it's going to find this new energy, but at the moment, like, indies are being left behind, and they could become, you know, very irrelevant unless it's not, and it's not about the films themselves.
Yeah,
it's just about how are they going to reach an audience.
No, that's fair enough. So it's an evolutionary step.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, you can see yourself how many interesting indie filmmakers, even American indie filmmakers, have now gone into television because they just want to tell stories. And they also want to, I mean, making a film in itself is great, but it's only half of it. Obviously, unless you can connect with an audience, there's no point in really making a film. So a lot of indies are going into making interesting character-driven TV because they know they're going to have some kind of audience for it. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be, you know, a lot of people returning back into making films as well, or doing a sideline, a parallel thing, where you're doing, you know, like we were talking about Stephen Frears earlier, who Stephen Frears often worked in smaller independent films and would also make, you know, high-end, like commercial Hollywood cinema, just to make it financially viable as well to make films, which is a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm. Where can people see Bruno?
That's a very good question. Where can they see it? We'll know soon in terms of wherever your audience are listening to it. Obviously, if your audience is in Germany or Austria, you can see it in cinemas starting on October 15th. If you're in the UK and Ireland, I think we will be doing something closer to Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And we are also hoping to have some news about a platform soon, but we're in talks at the moment, so hopefully that's something that we'll be announcing soon.
Okay, final question. Given the circumstances that we now find ourselves in,
yeah,
with the pandemic and probably with the ongoing presence of COVID-19, is there anything that this situation has enabled you to do that you weren't able to do before?
Yeah, I mean, as obvious as it sounds, I would say think, to actually sit down and think a little bit more about, because, you know, at the start of this year, it was all about pressing forward in projects and just driving on. And, you know, you're just like, it's a machine-like response. You know, you're just charging forward, and you, as a filmmaker, particularly an indie filmmaker, you've got to have multiple things going on. When all the plates collapse to the ground and you're kind of left with nothing for a moment, you do have to think about, you know, like, what is this all about? Where are the stories that I'm excited about, and how will I bring them to life? And so I've been thinking about that a lot more. So I've been experimenting with other, I'm writing a kid's book right now, which is started in lockdown. Would never have written a kid's book before. I tell my kids stories all the time. And it was during lockdown that I was telling a lot of them, and they finally said, well, why don't you just write a book about it? And I was like, yeah. And then I was like, oh, actually, that's not a bad idea. but, you know, so you have a pause to think and to get excited by stuff again, you know, just to, you know, long days for anyone with kids or without kids, you know, it's a long days that you're trying to fill and also still be excited. And so I started to watch films that I really liked again. I mean, I hadn't watched The Godfather for a few years, but Godfather 1 and 2 were films that I was amazed by when I first saw them. So I screened those for myself. And a lot of 70s films, which is kind of what I'm excited by. Mm-hmm. And remembering like what this is all about and why it's worth it. So I guess having a chance to be inspired again a little bit is maybe one of the things from lockdown.
That's certainly one of the things I've found. We're not always talking about new films because there obviously isn't that stream of new material.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a golden opportunity to actually reevaluate a lot of movies that might have passed you by or a lot of classics that you never really found the time
right.
for.
I think that's interesting that people, you know, people often will say, oh, well, I'll watch those Melville films when I'm, you know, and you know, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll read Charles Dickens. I've actually been reading a lot too recently, a lot more than I have for years. But with films in particular, there's just that world of films that you mightn't have got to, and not having new films coming at you all the time has been really nice for me, because I'm always obsessed by what's new, what's the new release. And
mm-hmm.
when you move that space away, it kind of means that you can, certainly revisit stuff, you know?
Because that's the funny thing is that for me, looking at digital releases, a new release doesn't mean a new film. A new release can be an old film or a film that's been polished or given a digital upgrade or whatever, and you can sit down and rewatch it again. I found myself rewatching a digitally restored version of Escape from New York and loving it to bits for the super saturated negative.
Mm-hmm.
And same with the restoration of Jaws and Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you're finding time for this stuff, which previously was like, oh, yes, I really must get round two.
Right. I actually watched Serpico again the other night, and I love Sidney Lumet. I think he's just someone who always excited me, but I hadn't seen Serpico for a long, really long time.
Mm.
And it wasn't the restored version or anything. It was still, you know, an old crappy DVD that's been on my shelf for years. But it was just great. Like, mm-hmm. to sort of, I would not necessarily have done that, you know, if I was like in full, you know, engagement with the world and with the industry. But now that things are about, okay, well, just let's see where this goes. There is time to do things like that. And it's, of course, it's a spectacular film, but it's still interesting and gritty and relevant. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens when if people are going back and they're dipping again into influences, what will happen? You know, it's obviously the other thing during my thinking phase of like, well, what's it going to look like?
Yeah.
What are the movies that are going to be? And, yeah, practical terms, you're going to be seeing a lot of films, of course, without very many crowd scenes. I think we're going to be overloaded with sort of solitary existential thrillers, you know, single location stuff, all that kind of practical stuff. You know, I'm hoping that like a darkness won't descend on film, or sort of a fashionable darkness, you know, where everything's, you know, dark and weary and tragic and deep. That I hope that there will also be playful stuff.
Because we need to be lifted up.
We need to be lifted up. And I think, you know, this is a conversation about people watching the films that really they loved. If people are connecting with those things again, maybe that will inspire, you know, new kinds of work, or something interesting might happen now that we've all had to drop our assumptions about the world.
Sure.
You know, this very, you know, safe, structured place that we think we've all been occupying. Once we realize that that's a sort of fallacy, you know, things fall apart. Like, how do you start again? And I mean, it's a great dramatic story again, you know. And going back to sort of Bruno, like, that's an interesting thing. One of the things about the film was I had failed as a filmmaker in a way that I hadn't done the sort of films I really wanted to. And then I'd gone to Los Angeles and it'd just been exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of came back just thinking, oh my God, I failed like making these sort of, I thought I was going to do these Tony Scott films. I love Tony Scott. and it just kept falling apart. And then, so this idea of a sort of a rebirth was probably one of the seeds of Bruno, mm-hmm. you know, and it was a rebirth because I went back and started to write again. And I, you know, physically was just making a film in a way that I hadn't done for a while. And creative rebirths and the story of somebody coming back to some kind of new moment, new point in their life is really interesting to me. In Bruno, it's there, it's part of the story. And I think in life in general, this idea of having to take a fresh start and really look at where you're at and have to sort of begin again, mm-hmm. it can be a really complicated energy, but it can also be a very constructive energy. And I think, you know, let's see, but I really think stuff will be interesting in terms of how music is made to
yeah.
how art is produced, galleries are shut down, these big scale international cultural events, you know.
This is always the guarantee with adversity, is you know that there's going to be some fantastic art coming off the back of it.
Right. Yeah. And people are just, you know, depressed, angry, frustrated, you know, people are going back into their living rooms to record a song or, you know, or trying something different, you mm-hmm. know, and I hope some of that will find a way back out into the market. And like indie film, how do any of these art space, how do musicians return to live performance? How do galleries reopen? All these things are questions for everybody, but I feel like new ways of doing things are going to happen.
Which movie have you revisited that actually didn't match your memory of it?
That's a good question. Actually, I rewatched a Melville film, Red Circle,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't that I didn't like it. I mean, I used to love Melville films, because they didn't have dialogue and they were so, you know, everything was achieved very simply. And for some reason, I found it, it's an amazing film and it's beautifully shot of the era, but I found it somehow a little cynical. I don't know
mm-hmm.
why.
Mm-hmm.
I was missing, and maybe it's because of where we're all at, but I felt like what used to be this cool, detached French film
yeah.
somehow felt very cold to me. And I wanted the characters just to...
Do you think that was speaking to you at a different stage of life? Yeah. Or do you think it was speaking to you when the world and its values were very different?
I mean, both things. I mean, certainly, you know, when you're growing up, watching Alain Delon sort of light up another cigarette and just not say anything with a gun in his pocket is... You can watch that all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at some point, it's interesting to see... I mean, it's of course because he's a genius filmmaker. He's allowing you an insight into somebody who you know. There's a tragedy that's around somebody that chooses mm-hmm. to live their life. I mean, he makes these wonderful films about basically tragic characters because they can't really connect in some way. Disconnection is very exciting, you know. When you're younger, it's less exciting. When you're moving through life and you have a family and you're bringing kids into the world and you're encouraging them to find ways to connect.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I don't know, the kind of something like that that's a little bit cool and so well structured. And again, of where I'm at now, there's something about messiness that I'm kind of more interested in mm-hmm. right now. But that doesn't mean to say that it's not a film that I think is still very memorable. But I suddenly thought, do I want to watch this film again? Like, I don't know if I would sit down and watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
But when
mm-hmm.
I watched Serpico, to go back to Serpico, I was thinking, wow, I can't believe, it was like seeing an old friend. It's like, wow, I can't believe I haven't seen this for 5 years or something. And because, you know, because Pacino is so much like a lost man, except... with him, you get all the need to connect, mm-hmm. and you get all this emotional world where Sidney Lumet does so well. He's not just a cool outsider smoking cigarettes. He's a guy who's doomed, and he knows he's doomed, and he's desperately just trying to reach out and do something. And that feels really just emotional and just gets to me. And the little scenes in Serpico's apartment are as exciting as these massive epic shots of New York. So these two worlds, the small apartment in Greenwich Village and these big shots of New York and City Hall. I don't know why when I revisited that film, it really shook me and made me like excited just to watch all of those Lumette films again from the 70s, you know.
It's funny, I found myself watching the cop thriller Nighthawks.
Oh, right.
With Sylvester Stallone and Rutger Hauer. And I have a big fondness for Rutger Hauer's performances.
Yeah.
And particularly in that period, I was marveling at the efficiency at which he could create this sense of disquietment with so little. It was a very, very economical approach. Maybe it's the thing about that period, maybe it's about the 70s, early 80s, where everything just felt a little bit more visceral,
right?
Not quite so polished, and that had an inbuilt authenticity without even trying.
I mean, it's interesting that you go back to something like that because, like, I found, like, I've been eating a lot of comfort food.
Sure.
And in these times, and I think comfort viewing is also an interesting concept too. I mean, there's lots of sort of slightly dodgy films. Like, I have a thing where I like to watch films, like the so-called minor films of great filmmakers, you know, so like, for example, Frantic by Roman Polanski. I adore that film as much as I adore Chinatown.
Right.
It's a very generic kind of film in lots of ways, but it's so masterful in other ways. And that kind of watching stuff that just somehow does feel alive, and it's hard to know why, but there's just something happening in those, in certain types of films, particularly, I think films are interesting that you're offering. It's often kind of echoing something of when you first watch it. It comes with a lot of baggage.
Sure.
Good and bad.
I think you have expectations of how you're going to be entertained.
And right.
Then it's funny because sometimes I'll watch a film where there's a lot of pressure for it to meet my expectations. Classic off the wrist example would be some of the recent Bond films that I watched. I didn't really enjoy them the first time round.
Yeah.
But once the rabbit was fully out of the bag,
right,
I could enjoy other aspects of it.
I mean, I agree with that. Strangely, I watched the new Blade Runner again with Ryan Gosling, and I didn't like it when I first saw it.
Interesting.
And I love the director. I love everything about that film. I think I went into it just way too excited when it first came out. Like, I was excited and it just left me a little cold. And then I watched it again and went, just as a standalone, this is great. And I felt like, and been listening to the score actually a lot recently, which is an amazing score. And so, yeah, revisiting expectation in films can be difficult, but also the expectation of rewatching, like Blade Runner itself is an interesting, Ridley Scott's Blade Runner is interesting because I sometimes get nervous. Like, I don't watch it religiously, but I do watch it every now and again. And I do sometimes worry about the day that I'm going to put it on and go, oh, okay, fine, whatever.
I haven't found the bottom of the barrel yet.
And it's, you know, it's going to happen, maybe. I don't know. But it's just, you know, if I'm honest, it happened with Woody Allen, where I used to watch Annie Hall when I was in college all the time. I used to find Annie Hall and Manhattan were the two that were just so exciting. And they're still amazing to me, but somehow I've watched them too much.
But Woody's changed. He's not the guy who did Bananas or Love and Death. He's a very, very different filmmaker from where he started.
He for sure, but I think what I liked about, let's say particularly Manhattan, is that I think it was a bridge into the really interesting stuff, like of the 80s and early 90s that he did. My favorite, he's another of the kind of minor films by master filmmakers, which I'd like to do a series on at some point, is like Husbands and Wives is my favorite Woody Allen film, even though it's never mentioned when people talk about the great Woody Allen films. And a friend, I worked with a producer on my first film who had also produced a Woody Allen film, and I didn't want to mention it until we'd finished. And I was like, look, if there's any chance you could get a poster signed, and she said absolutely. She was going to New York and she said, so what is it, you want Annie Hall, you want Manhattan? I was like, no, actually Husbands and Wives. And I had to find a poster. She brought it all the way to New York. And when he signed it, it's still in my office across the street. When he signed it, he actually wrote, "Thanks, this is my best film, Woody Allen."
Oh.
And I think it's like nobody would have thought about, like, please sign the husbands and wives. And it's a terrible poster as well.
Sure.
Because it's a film that got forgotten. But to me, like, Manhattan, like, was that move into this. And I find, like, Husbands and Wives is maybe a film that I'm still, like, I just can keep watching it because it feels like it's unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
Liam Neeson is just unreal. He's so strange and interesting, and it feels unpredictable. Mm-hmm. But there's also those moments with great filmmakers where you worry that, oh my God, would I just feel like I've seen this like too many times?
It's funny. I mean, just to bring you back to Blade Runner momentarily, that's the acid test. Is how many conversations does that film create after you've seen it?
Yeah. I mean, it's... He was the perfect director for that film because he has a very particular strong voice. I mean, he's an immense director, and it's kind of almost nice that he's not producing a film a year right now as he was. And I think he was... When I rewatched it, I sort of suddenly felt a little bit more of his version of the film. I went in with my expectation of sort of the Ridley Scott version, and
sure.
And of course, you know, that could only be sort of somehow anticlimactic. But when I watched it again and just saw it as a film that this filmmaker that I love had made, it had all sorts of echoes for me of the previous iconic film. But then you felt the spaces that he was occupying and you could feel his voice more.
See, the funny thing is, I'd almost credit and thank George Lucas for the Star Wars prequels.
Yeah.
And doing those before I saw the sequel to Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Because they kind of gently trampled on my childhood.
Right.
And so I kind of stopped being precious about that franchise. So when they announced and said, hey, we're going to do a sequel to Blade Runner, part of me had already emotionally let go before the announcement came.
Yeah.
And I could kind of feel excited for the right reasons and not carry the burden of expectation into the screening theatre. The other thing I must say is that I still think Ryan Gosling's best performance by a country mile.
Yeah. He's great. And just, you know, looking at it again, I was thinking there's very few movie stars, because it sort of needs a star to hold that thing together.
Sure.
There's very few that would have somehow tonally just been able to capture that. He is great, and again, he's very comfortable with doing with seeming to do very little, and he has an amazing stillness anyway as an actor. And I thought he was sensational, yeah.
I think the other thing that I really enjoyed about it, and I had this little fanboy jump in the cinema seat when I first watched it, was the opening scene, which is actually the first planned opening scene for Blade Runner. The thing I absolutely loved about that scene was Dave Bautista.
Yeah.
And how self-contained and how measured. And to be honest, for me in that scene, he's doing all the heavy lifting.
Right.
And Gosling is... can afford to be more anonymous.
Right.
And I love the energy between the two. And that set the film.
It is actually a great scene. And we were talking earlier before we were rolling about sort of editing. And it's a really beautifully cut scene too. You know, you're waiting for a movie star to sort of early on in the film be the movie star. But that scene plays it completely differently, and itly, so as not to bore an audience. And you know, I don't know the running time of that opening sequence, but I remember when I rewatched it thinking how nice that they're confident enough in the atmosphere to just let this unfold. And we know something's going to happen.
And
that's just great filmmaking.
But that was one of the things, is that we've had this lurch towards very fast-paced, fast cuts, post-MTV kind of stuff. And I like this gradual reintroduction of longer and longer takes.
Right.
Because they're using longer takes or longer shots to introduce a sense of tension rather than can you keep up with the barrage of images.
Right. And it's a different, I mean, I think he has it as a director. I mean, talking about Frantic, Roman Polanski, in that film, which is a bit of a throwaway Roman Polanski film, given his body of work, but he lets shots run. I mean, I still love, there's a shot of Harrison Ford just in the shower in the hotel room, and it's just Harrison Ford kind of in the shower, sort of slightly soft in the foreground, and the sort of the shower water coming down over the door, so slowly distorting what's in the background. And then you just see, you know, a suitcase being dragged away, his wife goes off frame, and you're, you know, a lesser filmmaker would have, you know, cut to, you know, maybe a reverse angle mm-hmm. on Harrison Ford, you know, maybe the dreaded coverage of coming out even further into sure. the hotel. He just plays that all in one shot, and it goes on for a couple of minutes, and you want to smack the screen and go wake up and look around.
Yeah.
Right, and it's, you know, it's so simple when you talk about it afterwards. It's very hard to commit to that and think, will an audience go with it? And again, talking about Sidney Lumet earlier, in Serpico, I was just blown away by how many shots were he just let. You know, he would let a scene run, and even a dialogue scene, either he would have a fixed shot on Pacino and other people are kind of around the room coming in and out of frame mm-hmm. talking, which is very confident filmmaking, or, you know, he would have maybe two or three positions over quite a lengthy dialogue scene. And it's kind of amazing that he would just, it's very slow paced.
Because it kind of throws up a question, which to you as the director, how conscious are you of the edit or the way a scene or a shot is going to be edited whilst you're shooting vis-a-vis keeping it loose, keeping it fresh, keeping it sufficiently mobile that magic can still happen at the fringes?
I mean, I'm not really thinking obsessively about the cut. I mean, it depends on how you do it. I don't do formal storyboarding. I do a sort of matchstick storyboard for myself, and I go through the whole, tragically, some people have to look at that and try to make sense of it. But, but generally, I keep it for myself. And so I've basically told the story with matchstick men for myself from beginning to end, and then hopefully things happen that prevent me from just doing the matchstick men version. But because I came initially from theater, so my way in is not, I'm not a film director who's going to do like a 60-foot, you know, crane shot into an eyeball. Mm-hmm. I'm not a stylist. I came from theater, from performances. I'm very comfortable with actors. They're my way into any film, and spending time with them and getting a performance and creating an environment is more. So usually I'm only moving on if I feel like if there's something in the performance where I know that we have it and that we could do multiple versions of it, but it's only going to sink slowly.
Yeah, because the energy's peaked.
The energy's peaked, and usually you can tell very easily. You know, you can tell when the ideas are getting worse in a performance, and then some actors start to get frustrated and they lose their... So, you know, part of being a director is you're trying to create... You're definitely not looking just to... You're not like a friend on set, because that's the last thing you should be to an actor. But you're trying to create an environment whereby they kind of know that you know what you're doing, and you have a good view in the performance, and they mm-hmm. trust you, mm-hmm. you know? So that's when I move on. It's the Brando story, the Marlon Brando story, but he used to, you know, with new directors he hadn't worked with, he would give them day one, first take, he would do it, and then if the director came over and said, okay, do it again, he'd give Brando notes, which is good luck with that.
Yeah.
Brando's test would to do it exactly the same. for the second take. And if the director came over and went, great, awesome, let's move on, Brando would know that this guy was a fucking idiot, didn't know his stuff, and
sure,
forget about trying to direct him for the rest of the film. He was not going to bother.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is an interesting thing of, I mean, there's lots of really great directors who actually are not particularly good with actors.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, that's what I'm interested in. So when I feel there's an emotion that's working that I know is going to sort of work and cut together, then that's when I feel very comfortable. If it's not there, the worst is if you feel like, well, we could probably make this work in the cutting room, that's horrible.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, I would always try to, I mean, even on something like Bruno, where we didn't have a lot of breathing space, there was one, we shot one scene and I just didn't feel comfortable with it. It would all have cut together. I got my editor to work very quickly overnight. He said, yeah, look, it's going to be fine. It all cuts together. But when I saw it, I was like, yeah, but just so somehow we actually fit it in into the next day, like an hour to do it. And we got like, I think, two takes just to do it. And of course, that's the version that we now use in the film, because it was just a disconnection with them emotionally. Somehow it didn't work. And so that's what I'm looking for. Once the emotion is there,
mm-hmm.
you know, yes, in a dream world, Roger Deakins would be shooting your film and everything would be spectacular. But actually, the pictures themselves are less interesting to me than, you know, the eyes of the actor. Like, what's really going on with an actor?
Mm-hmm.
Are you with them?
Yeah.
Do you get a sense of something else? You know, it's like a screenplay. There's all the words on the page, but what's going on behind the words? Is there something mm-hmm. else that's interesting? And once you have that, I think everything can cut together. The same with cinematography. You don't need 20 lights. We did this with one light. That's it. I gave my cinematographer one light. And so you don't need multiple things. Sometimes just simple, mm-hmm. simple, simple. You know?
Mm-hmm. It's funny you mentioned Deakins, because certainly now at this point in his career, he's always trying to tone down the styling of his lighting. He's trying to not make it feel too self-evident in the shots.
Right. For sure. I think it's the same thing. I think it's like masters will often simplify their style. I mean, I remember being in the National Gallery in London and seeing in a room with like multiple Claude Monet pictures and seeing what his last pictures were like compared mm-hmm. to the ones over The Art of a Young Man, where he was showing off a little bit because he's so dazzling as a technical painter. And then by the end, he was doing the same but with less.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing a Mike Hodges film as well recently or a while ago, whereby he was doing so much. It must have been very, because I don't think he's making films anymore, but he was just moving the camera very slightly
mm-hmm.
rather than cutting. And that idea of reducing a style down once you know how to do something, I find that really interesting mm-hmm. that you literally have to do less. And I think Deakins is doing it too. Ironically, everyone watches a film that he shot expecting
the dazzling
stuff. Yeah. And he's working with interesting directors right now who are okay with things not always being dazzling. So it's a lot more understated.
Mm-hmm.
But he seems to be somebody who's interested clearly in serving the story and not, he obviously doesn't want to be the star. You know, he's not looking to be the main attraction of everything. He's literally trying to serve. If it's a story about like a candlelight or a torch, he's going to use that.
Yeah.
But he can also spend 2 days lighting a set.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that just comes again from like a master craftsman's approach.
Well, he comes across as being very professional in his own, very comfortable in his own professional skin.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't have to try. And maybe there's this sort of happy, how can I put it? Not accident per se, but a perfect storm when you have talents where they don't have to try.
Right.
I was recently watching Waiting for the Barbarians.
Right.
And it was funny because I was right at the I liked the film. The film's solid. It's okay. It's not a classic. But I was absolutely raving about Mark Rylance's performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying to a friend of mine, finally cinema knows what to do with Mark Rylance.
Right.
Because having seen him on stage in Jerusalem,
yeah,
and just being so, again, shrunk into the skin of the character that he's playing,
yeah,
he didn't have to try.
Yeah.
And in a way, I kind of felt sorry for Johnny Depp. He was trying.
Yeah.
And you could see, just because Rylance was being so effortless,
yeah,
even if Johnny Depp didn't have his foot on the accelerator, it felt like he did.
Yeah.
And I felt really sorry for him. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
It's that thing of like Christian Bale in The Fighter, who's like the subplot to the Mark Wahlberg story. And yet,
yeah,
just by dint of the performance, you just kind of go, oh shit, it's actually your movie now.
Right. Yeah. And it's a nightmare for an actor to, when any actor realizes that they're being outperformed in some way,
mm-hmm,
it's obviously a nightmare because it breeds a sort of insecurity. But you know, when you're up against the Roger Federer of acting, in like there's a sort of gracefulness that comes from. I actually watched the other film that I was thinking about a while ago. Is I watched Bridge of Spies,
mm-hmm,
again, which I just think is a really, really interesting film, and I was so unexpected when I saw that film. And talking about, I mean, Spielberg does these one takes,
mm-hmm,
all his career. He's always, sure, done these one takes, which he never seems to get any credit for.
Mm-hmm.
People think he's a kind of risk averse filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
But the opening sequence of that, the opening like 15 minutes is sensational.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Mark Rylance is very, very, very comfortable,
mm-hmm,
in that opening scene in the apartment. He's in his underwear painting or hiding the coded message. And it's so well done. And you also know that Spielberg understands that you don't need 20 angles of Mark Rylance. You just, mm-hmm, need to literally capture what he's doing. And I thought that was one of the few times where he's been allowed to deliver something on screen. I think it's very hard for such a majestic actor.
Mm-hmm.
How do you translate what they have that you might see on screen,
mm-hmm,
on a stage? How do you translate that onto screen? The stop-start nature of filmmaking doesn't always work for such a powerful actor like, mm-hmm, that. And yet when you capture it simply, you get something, you know?
Talking about capturing it simply, I returned to watching Joel Schumacher's Phone Booth.
Oh, wow, yeah.
With Colin Farrell. And whilst I really enjoyed the film, and I may have a slight problem with Kiefer Sutherland being too obviously creepy,
right,
as the nemesis, the biggest joy was actually watching the B-roll after scenes where they have this 10-minute take.
Yeah.
Where Farrell's having to do everything himself inside this phone booth, and he's going for 10 minutes straight, and it's just one take, and you just kind of think, wow, this is the Ferrari allowed to go into fifth gear.
Right. It's interesting, right? I, you know, it's funny because firstly, you know, what's been sitting on my desk is actually Falling Down. I love Joel Schumacher,
and, mm-hmm,
and often when a filmmaker, you know, passes away, I'll watch one of their films just as a mark of respect almost. So, you know, when Alan Parker died, I rewatched Mississippi Burning, which is insanely good still. And just,
yeah,
I mean, Gene Hackman and William Defoe together, Hackman is, everything we were talking about with Mark Rylance applies, yeah, to Gene Hackman.
For sure.
He's so comfortable in his skin.
Mm-hmm.
That it's almost like you're not really watching a performance. He plays the exact opposite of what that character was sort of written. He just has this weird charm, and yet he's a man who's kind of lost and confused, mm-hmm, by everything that's happening. But with the going back to the phone booth, is great, and Colin Farrell is great. And again, because he's a movie star, you know, he's somebody who doesn't often get a chance to really show what they can do. But again, he's an actor who started on stage,
mm-hmm,
which is a classic sign. Why are so many Irish and British actors successful? Like Michael Fassbender is another example of somebody, mm-hmm, who's been on stage. And when you when you can sort of, when you have the courage to go on a stage without any safety net.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's why sometimes American screen actors are great about the technical approach to how to make films, but, you know, they haven't necessarily put themselves out in the same way as
sure.
a lot of, you know, most actors that you're seeing working in the UK have done stage work at some point. And if you let them, you can, if you let them run with it, and I love Phone Booth. I think it's so, it sort of embraces the B movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying like, we're B movie.
Yeah.
But it's got this crazy energy. And yeah, Kiefer Sutherland is too much. And yet he doesn't really spoil it because
no.
whole street life and that whole build up, you know, it's this kind of build up to the phone booth. And then what he does, Joel Schumacher, because he was such a great storyteller, you know, what he does is he exploits that situation
sure.
to its fullest. And I mean, when you look at Colin Farrell in the film, he looks so young.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was the first sign of like, why is he still making interesting films? It's because there's clearly this really strong talent. And it's interesting to see him, you know, get a second wind as a filmmaker after,
sure.
as a film actor, after he'd been making so many dud kind of Hollywood movies. And then something happened that he just was comfortable with being almost a character actor again.
I think that's it. He allowed himself to become a character actor. That's how it feels in the output that's come through. Because if you look at his performance in, say, Killing of a Sacred Deer,
yeah.
he's now totally, this is me, I'm the character actor now.
Right.
He's not trying to, he's not gunning
yeah.
for leading man or sort of, you know, eye candy roles.
Right. And it's not showy. It's not a sort of showy, it's actually the more difficult kind of role to play, but he's, and he, you know, some of it is, once you get into that space with an interesting director,
mm-hmm.
it allows other people who might be resistant maybe to you or, you know, to sort of open up to you. And so he's been very, very good about just sort of, you know, fine, thank God, not doing, you know, this sort of movies that he found himself doing for a few years, and he's a survivor. I mean, I find him really interesting because he's just, very few people start off with that explosion that he had.
Sure.
With Joel Schumacher again, you know, I think the very first real Hollywood film he made was with Joel Schumacher, Tigerland. And that was the first time Hollywood saw, oh my God, who's this guy?
Yeah.
And he went on that sort of, and that the star was explosive. At one point, I mean, he worked with everybody. It's insane, mm-hmm. all the directors, but it just, he hit a plateau and somehow he managed to get out
yeah.
and do really interesting stuff. It's like the Christian Bale thing of like, how do you keep on going? And how do you, as an actor, how do you keep on somehow reinventing yourself? And so, and I admire that kind of spirit of people who've taken the long road, and once they've committed to it, then interesting things happen.
But I think it's that, it's an actor's choice where they're deliberately trying to maintain a sense of mystery.
Right.
So that allows the audience to buy into the disbelief
yeah.
that, oh, it's Christian Bale again.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Gary Oldman. Oh, it's whoever it might be. So that they can still inhabit the character.
Right. And but that's a tradition that a lot of really interesting screen actors had in the past, you know, like Redford Paul Newman is the classic example. A director who worked with him was talking about the fact that Newman just was like so quiet on set, and he never did press, he never did publicity. He reluctantly would go and promote, but if you tried to find Paul Newman on a talk show, it's very hard to find.
Sure.
Because he was so, and Redford, who's so iconic as well, and now it's a reality. If you're a young actor, you have to be on social media,
mm-hmm.
you have to constantly promote yourself, you have to be seen at the right venues, and
you have to almost arrive with a ready-made audience.
You have to, and you're a brand, and there's nothing wrong with that in this I mean, there is, if I'm honest, but there's nothing wrong with it. That's just the way it is. I mean, you can't pop out of drama school and go, well, you know what, I'm only going to do this or that. You have to find a market for yourself before it kind of exists. Same thing, by the way, is true of filmmakers or musicians, too. You know, now there is a push for actors to be a lot more prominent, and there's a sort of, you know, if you become tabloid fodder, like in a way, that's a lot of what agents want, that you're on the front pages. But of course, it never leads to the really. It doesn't necessarily lead to the really interesting stuff, you know, like Pacino again in Sidney Lumet, like what a strange, interesting guy he is when you see him interviewed. Mm-hmm. Incredible actor, but there's something about him personally as well that kind of makes him into the actor that he is. Mm-hmm. And it's a very rare thing. And I think Mark Rylance is in the same category too, of somebody who's, you know, clearly committed to a certain type of acting and mm-hmm. now has a platform, which is amazing. But it doesn't obviously, there's lots of people who are never get to that point, and who are kind of, there's lots of actors who just haven't found that commercial level yet, mm-hmm. but are still committed to that journey, you know.
Fantastic.
All right. So that was a little epic, was it?
No, so that's good. I enjoyed it. I mean, this is the thing. This is the really nice thing, is that when you're interviewing somebody, when you're talking to somebody, and it just rolls of its own accord. It's not like, oh, you're here to promote a movie. I'm here to ask you questions.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting when it goes off to the side. Thankfully, we didn't get onto neuroscience, which is my new topic right now. So, but no, it's always good just to meander your way through a conversation about movies. So thank you.
No, my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for being on the show.
Okay, wonderful.
Cheers.
Ciao.
Bye.
Once again, my thanks to Carl Golden for its wonderfully in-depth interview. If you'd like to see his new film, Bruno, it will be on cinema release in Germany from October the 15th onwards, and then available on streaming later. If you like what you heard and fancy listening to some more No Spoiler reviews, please check out our previous episodes available on Apple, Alexa, Spotify, and all the other regular podcasting platforms. Also, if you'd like to be kept up to date with our fortnightly movie podcasts, please consider subscribing. Hit the bell, smash the like, and share either or both of this week's podcasts. It really does make a difference, and we really do appreciate your support. Please keep safe, take all reasonable precautions, and we wish you all the best for a spoiler-free time. Look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks. Bye.